Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona Shaw, how are you doing today?
Hi, Mark. Well, we're getting very anxious because we're getting very close to the April 28th deadline.
Yeah, April 28th deadline. What's that mean?
Well, that's the date, the official date that the program sunsets. But of course, as we all know, something is going to happen because nobody's going to let this program die. And I'm terribly excited today to have on our show Adam Green from Live in America. Hi, Adam.
Good morning. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm happy to have Adam on as well. So Adam Green is the president of Live in America, which is the EB5 platform owned by the LCP Group. The Live in America platform has successfully sponsored EB5 projects with foreign investment capital exceeding $500 million. They've also received project and investor approvals for 100% of the petitions that have been adjudicated to date. Adam, welcome to the show.
Mark, thanks a lot for having me.
Well, the other reason we really wanted Adam to be on this show, Mark, was because not only did we want him to talk a little bit about, you know, risks in EB5 real estate projects and what to look for, but basically to talk a little bit about what's going on right now. As I said, we're all pretty anxious as we're so close to the due date. Actually, Mark, Adam is very involved because Adam is the vice chair of the Public Policy Committee, which is a very important committee, as the Public Policy Committee really looks at things like, you know, what the current legislation is saying, how can we reword it, what are the issues. Take it away, Adam.
Yes, and thank you, Mona. And I should also acknowledge that Mona is a very important member of that committee as well. We've worked together very extensively over the past year working on the issues. So on April 28th, the regional center program within the EB5 legislation will sunset. And it's been extended 5 times on a short-term basis over the last 3 years. And we're looking for an extension or possibly new legislation around the EB5 rules. The reason why we're optimistic this time around, after 5 short-term extensions, that there'll be some sort of new rule is that there have been draft regulations issued by the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. They issued regulations on January 13th, and the comment period expired on April 11th. So there are now draft regulations which may become the new rules for the EB5 program sometime over the summer. That brings all parties to the table, both EB5 practitioners, legislators, and regulators, to come together to either agree that the new regulations will take effect or hopefully to come up with a new set of rules that will be codified in new legislation.
Right. That's an awful lot to take in, an awful lot to digest, Adam. And I know right now it's a little premature, but we are really working very closely. The Public Policy Committee, I should say, is working very closely with Capitol Hill on drafting legislation.
Right. And some of the larger issues that are coming up in this draft legislation have to do with the dollar amounts that will be required for EB5 investment, which, as you know, have been...
Well, everybody's holding their breath for that.
that's for sure. So since the law was put into place in 1990, the dollar amounts have been $1 million for a normal investment or reduced to $500,000 if you're within a targeted employment area. Of course, more than 98% of the visas issued last year were at the $500,000 level. So the big question is, what will the new dollar amounts be? And the bookends seem to be an extension as is for some short period of time. So we would retain that $500,000 level.
Well, that's what the general understanding is, that we have a little time. But the issue is, people ask me all the time, how long till? And I don't even like to say September, because technically it could be a couple of months from now. We could have a deal well before September.
Exactly right. And the other pressure point on that is that the regulations can take effect now after the Immigration Service gets through the 800-some-odd comments that it received in response to the notice of proposed rulemaking.
Right. And the due date of that was last week.
Correct. April 11th.
Right.
So that means that the new regulations can take effect over the summer. And those regulations as drafted had the investment amount being a minimum of $1.35 million for a TEA and up to $1.8 million. Now, there's general agreement, I think, in the industry. I think you'll agree too, Mona, that those numbers were put out there as a bookend, as a high amount. And many people in the industry indicated that that would really, really kill the program and potentially reduce the job creating effects of the program. So
it will, but we do expect to see increased amounts at least I would say by 800,000. And I don't think 800,000 would hurt the market too much.
I think people are prepared for 800,000. It seems to be what people have been talking about, and there's various reasons why it makes sense, having to do with inflation from 500,000 and on other justifications, but the fact of the matter is we don't know. And this is why we believe the industry and legislators and regulators are coming together to have new legislation rather than deferring to just the regulations.
Right. Well, we asked a lot of our clients, our regional center clients especially, to write something for us so we could send that to USCIS as well, as well as all of the stuff that we're doing with IIUSA. But we're going to have you back on the show later, Adam, to discuss a lot of the changes because all of these things are still in flux. But the one thing I did want to discuss is that we know for sure, no matter what else happens, that the investment amount will be going up. So as the investment amount goes up, the program is still at risk. Your money is still at risk. So now we're not talking about just 500,000 at risk, 800 or maybe a million. And I think one of the most important things moving forward for any investor as well as developer is understanding that people have a lot more to lose now. And they've always had a lot to lose before, but even more so now. And really, now we're looking at well-structured EB-5 deals, well-structured and percentages. You know, I can see a lot of changes moving forward with regards to what's presently on the...
on offer.
On offer, that's right.
Well, I appreciate the transition, and we feel pretty strongly that our background should give people comfort when they're looking for EB-5 deals. So we operate 23 regional centers that cover all...
Who's we again?
Live in America, yeah. Which is the subsidiary of the LCP group, operates 23 regional centers, which cover all or parts of 38 states and territories. So we got into this business 6 years ago based on our background in real estate. The LCP group itself has been around for over 40 years investing in real estate, including mostly offices and hotels.
You don't look that old, Adam.
Thank you very much. I only joined the company 6 years ago. But LCP spun off a public REIT, which still trades on the New York Stock Exchange as Lexington Realty Trust. And we've invested in hotels throughout the years, and we have an interest in a hotel operating company. My background is as a lender for construction. I started off at JP Morgan Chase in project financing, doing infrastructure financing for toll roads and pipelines and petrochemical plants, worked on some sports venues, including one that will be close to your heart, Wembley Stadium in London. And we took that background and we decided that we were going to bring it to the EB-5 business. There are plenty of really talented players in EB-5, and we don't think we have a franchise on talent, but we do think that our experience in financing real estate and also our footprint nationally in finding deals has given us a good look, and that's why we feel strongly about how we look at these deals.
Oh, yes, you're well-versed on EB-5 real estate. Mark, we've been having different types of guests, and our last guest did comment on the fact that there are deals outside of real estate. But I think today we would be focusing on real estate, as that's Adam's forte.
That makes sense, considering a large majority of the EB-5 projects have basis in real estate anyway. So it makes sense to take a deep dive into some of the risk elements of EB-5 real estate deals and see where we can identify and perhaps mitigate some risk early on.
I totally agree. And I think, Adam, you'll agree with me that moving forward with a higher investment amount, there's a lot more to look at when an investor comes in and looks at an EB-5 real estate deal.
Early on, when we got into this business, I remember reading an article by someone saying EB-5 risk is not investment risk. Investment risk, you look for a return, and and that's not what you're looking for in EB-5. We disagree with that because we're really looking at it as lenders for construction of real estate. And you may call it investment risk. We really call it credit risk, which is the risk that you can get repaid. And of course, the foremost risk that EB-5 investors are concerned about is whether they'll get their green card, but we want them to think about whether they'll get repaid. And that's not an original thought, but it's really important that people look at what credit risk is in EB-5 transactions. So when we think about a real estate project, we try to break it down pretty simply. And of course, each of these elements has a lot of detail behind it. But really, the risks that we look at are, can the sponsor get the project built? And after completion, can the operations support the debt service, both the EB-5 and other debt service that the project has to bear? The third thing we look at is, where in the capital stack does the EB-5 fit? Because that'll give you a clue as to whether or not there's a good chance of getting repaid. And then, of course, we always look at whether or not the EB-5 investment satisfies the criteria to get the investors their green card.
Very good points, Adam. But if I jump into one point that I keep on bringing up, large developers, well-known developers, is that really important to have a famous large developer in your experience?
So a large developer is not necessarily important, but an experienced developer is really important.
What's the difference in your book?
Well, so some of the developers we work with are not necessarily building billion-dollar projects, but we worked with developers, for example, in Washington, D.C. Our very first project is a $36 million apartment building in Washington, D.C., and there's a local development group that was involved there. They have been in the market for many years. They're experienced, and they had the financial wherewithal to do the project, but you never would have heard of them. But the postscript on that project, Mona, is that the project's complete. They're leasing up. All of the EB-5 investors have been approved, and of course, the project was approved. So what we really look for is someone who can execute in the market where they are. And that doesn't always mean a large developer.
Well, it's good that you say that, because we have quite a few developers who do listen regularly to the podcast and write to me and speak to me as well. And they do ask questions. They're developers, but they're just trying to learn about EB-5 and to see how EB-5 can fit. I often say, though, that, you know, EB-5 is not there for every project. And one of the biggest things about EB-5 is that it is cheap money, but it's very slow money.
Right, indeed. And so when you talk about large in that respect, you might be talking about financial wherewithal, because development projects take a very long time, as we know. But because the EB-5 takes a while to get in, the developer might have to plug the gap or find alternate sources of financing while they're waiting for the EB-5 to come in. But when we're thinking about the risk of getting a project completed, not necessarily the risk for developers, but the risks that investors might want to analyze, they're going to want to see that a developer can execute. So some of that is financial wherewithal, but a lot of it is experience.
Okay, so if somebody is looking for a project where they're looking at an experienced developer, not necessarily a large mon or a big name, for example, what would they look for?
So we're going to want to see developers who have successfully completed projects before. And, you know, that's a tricky one, isn't it? Right? Because people coming for money in EB-5 sometimes are first-time developers. And they may do a good job, but it's very difficult to bank a new developer, someone who's taking on a project that might be a lot larger than they have before or might be just be a new developer. It's just a tall order, especially when the flow of deals that we see based on our footprint involves a lot of people who have already had experience. So we feel pretty strongly that we want to see developers who have had success in projects that are similar to the one they're trying to finance and have successfully been able to coordinate the many different trades, many different companies, many different people who are involved in building a project. That's not a small order.
Well, Adam, if I may, let's explore that a little bit. So you mentioned this apartment complex in DC. It was a $36 million apartment complex, and you were looking for an experienced developer that had the ability to execute in the market. So it sounds like in this case, it worked out well, but how would that developer not have worked out? For example, let me try to ask a different way. A $36 million apartment complex, would you tap that same developer to build, say, a $100 million hotel?
Great question. While construction of a hotel, the actual physical construction, might not involve something too terribly different than apartment construction, we would be concerned about that developer's ability then to hire the right people to operate the hotel afterwards.
Right.
But then when you are talking about size and scope, which you mentioned there, Mark, a $100 million project is a lot different than $36 million. In fact, this one project is a great one to highlight, because in this case, this project was a little bit bigger than what these developers had done to date. So in this case, they were looking at a $36 million project where they had built maybe a $28, $29 million project. So it's sort of a marginal upsize.
But not threefold like the example I gave, right?
Exactly right.
Okay.
And here's why that matters when you get into the detail, right? So we like to summarize this whole risk on, can you get the project built? Which is a really nice and folksy way of saying it. But when we go into actually analyzing it, you want to make sure that this sponsor, the developer itself, knows the local contractors, is able to coordinate a bunch of different trades that are local in the market who have done projects that are this size and scope. So if I have someone that's going to frame out a project and they've only ever framed out a four-story stick project made of wood, then it's going to be difficult for us to feel comfortable that they know how to find the right contractor who can pour steel reinforced concrete up to the right level of floors, and that they can integrate that with other trades. So we want to make sure that the sponsor has a relationship, and that will often be overseen by a general contractor, but the sponsor needs to have a relationship with someone in the market who has actually built this stuff, so that they can get a handle not only on actually getting it done, but they can also feel good about the costs that they estimate to build the project. Because that same developer may take on a threefold project, as you mentioned earlier, Mark, and really just not be well equipped to understand that the costs are in line, or maybe they'll be 25 or 50% higher. Whereas if they're closer to the scale that they've been doing before, we feel a lot more confidence about the costs.
Right.
So, Adam, you know, real estate, when we talk about real estate, of course, location, it's all about location, location, location. But one of the big issues, and of course, one of the issues with the legislation, is this whole TEA designation. At this point, most of Manhattan, one way or another, can be utilized into a TEA. You yourself have a great project, One Wall Street, which I understand you've just got approved as well.
Just this morning.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, when I talk to investors, investors feel very confident in investing in a project in New York City, New York City being the real estate capital of the world. You have a project in New York City, you have projects elsewhere, but what's your feeling? Is it safer because it's in New York City?
I don't think it's necessarily safer, and a project is not necessarily safer because it's in New York City.
But why not? Wouldn't that be just a no-brainer that, you know, New York is Manhattan is Manhattan? It's the only place where the recession really didn't hit it. The rest of the country, the prices went down, but not in Manhattan.
All of that is true. But I think Manhattan is appealing for a couple of different reasons, not necessarily because it's safer. But the analogy I use all the time is, Mona, if you asked me to invest in China before I started this in this business, yeah, and hadn't traveled there, if you asked me to invest in China and you told me Hangzhou or Suzhou or Wenzhou are very good cities where there's really quality deals, I would probably have said to you, well, that may be true.
But I'd rather go to Shanghai or Beijing,
let's
right?
Stick with Shanghai or Beijing. So yeah. I know that investors in foreign markets are more comfortable with gateway cities that they've heard of, but that doesn't mean the real estate is better. And New York is a great place, and we believe in it. We believe in the resilience of New York real estate. But our sponsor for the One Wall Street deal, for example, sold apartments at $10,000 per square foot. But our very same sponsor here, Harry Macklow, recently was on Bloomberg in an interview saying, I don't think that market's that deep anymore. And the project that we're looking at now at One Wall Street and a couple of others are looking to sell apartments at more of the $2,500 to $3,000 per square foot. So
now that's interesting. But I, as I say, I often discuss this. And for the last 2 years, whenever I've gone out to places like China, I try to show that because we're expecting the TEA to come in, we're expecting Manhattan prices not to be at TEA level and move further up. Therefore, if anyone is looking to invest maybe a million plus, you know, you can't go wrong with New York City.
Well, projects have gone wrong in New York City. they do, and it depends on, of course, always the first question, who is the developer? But I generally agree with your premise, which is New York City is resilient. It's the worldwide city. When I was living here, I would call it the center of the universe. But you know, New York real estate prices certainly are resilient, but there has been a tremendous boom in hotel construction in New York, and where New York hotels would run at 90%, maybe they're losing a few percentage points, and there's other competition from other outlets, of course, like Airbnb. But I generally agree with the premise, but I also feel that it's not the only place to invest. Of course, we have Washington, D.C. projects, but you know, we have a project that we're working on in outside of Houston, Texas, which is a private school. And in that case, the school was already full, and so they needed a new facility. You'll be happy to know we only use construction jobs and not operating jobs for that reason. But the economics on that type of deal, we feel very strongly about. In that case, the construction was bridged, and it's, in fact, already completed. And so we think that, yeah, New York is a great place to invest. But what we're finding is some investors are not just looking for the big marquee projects. In fact, you've certainly been all around the world. Where in the world is Mona? More than I have. But what we're finding as we enter different markets is the marquee New York projects are not the only ones people are interested in. Some investors from some countries, when they think about credit risk and getting repaid and getting their green card, they actually prefer smaller projects and smaller markets because they know it'll get done and it'll be there.
Well, smaller projects for sure. But the one thing that I think is also going to be a change moving forward is the fact that investors will not be so satisfied at a return on their investment at 0.025 or however small amount it is. I mean, presently, the investors get enough in most of these projects to maybe buy a cup of coffee from Starbucks. So joking aside, I think that deals are going to have to be structured at least a minimum of 2% or more, which means that if we have to get the mathematics correct, someone has to be paid less, and it's probably likely to be the agents.
Well, I'm not sure who will get paid less, or maybe the developer will end up having to pay more, but there's definitely going to be a lot of pressure points, and I think that's more or less pushing on a balloon, right? Where does the money come from? But the fundamental premise of EB-5 money and what I explain to investors when they're asking about the return is that it's math, right? EB-5 takes a while to come in. If a developer wanted to look for mezzanine financing for construction,
which is the usual case,
which is usually what we offer, then they would be looking at, you know, a couple of years ago, maybe 10 or 11 or 12%. Maybe that's being pushed up now. So
that's a very high 12% for mezzanine finance.
Oh, it can go much higher for a construction loan. Okay. So an operating property would be less, but of course we're in construction lending here. So I think that there's only so high that you can push the EB-5 cost to the developer before it becomes unattractive. And that's not going to be at the same price as he might find his money from some other mezzanine loan provider who, as we say, has a checkbook. If someone has a checkbook and can show up at closing with the money, that's an important proposition. Would you pay 1% extra for that or 2% extra? You probably would. So EB-5 money has an actual natural cap based on how much people are charging for other types of finance. So I'm not so sure that there's unlimited room to provide investors an extra return. We talk about it internally a lot, and we do think there's another model for raising equity projects. But that is an entirely different paradigm, and it's different than just saying we'll give investors 2 or 3% more each year, because that puts a lot of pressure all around. One of the other risks we mentioned was, can a developer service the debt after completion? And that involves what is just basic credit analysis. It's, do the economics of the project support the debt load that the developer is taking on. That involves independent due diligence. And this is sort of banking 101 or credit 101. You want to make sure you get an independent study. You understand what's happening with the dynamics of the market. You talked a lot about New York, and we talked about how a $10,000 a foot apartment might not sell these days. What we're looking to see is an independent analysis involving objective facts, which helps us then project the cash flows of the project and understand if they can pay.
Here's the problem, Adam. There's been a spate of developer regional centers. There are a lot of developer regional centers. I can see the advantage of developer regional centers. However, if a developer is also a regional center raising money, they are not going to go out and get an independent third-party analysis. What would you say to somebody who wanted to look for one of those?
So we've heard of a lot of developer regional centers, and some of them are absolutely terrific, right? There are some very experienced developers out there who are doing great jobs. And then there is the other end of the spectrum where we've seen some would-be or apparent developers of projects who really don't have anything to build, and they end up taking the money. We think, again, that there are great developers out there, but we also think our model, where we are the third party, we act as a lender, and our only fiduciary responsibility is to the EB-5 investors. We think that provides a good check on what's happening, both a check for a good analysis of the project and a check on making sure the money goes where it's supposed to go. So we like our model. We hope that people feel comfortable with it. We don't think it's the only model, but we think it's a good one. And that also sort of rolls into another one of the risks, the third out of four risks that we were talking about, which is where in the capital stack is the EB-5 investment.
You did mention before that it's mostly usually the mezzanine loan.
Correct. So some developers will want to use this as a slice of equity. So the developers may be squeezing
the EB-5 money as a slice of equity.
Thank you. Yes. Some developers may want to use the EB-5 money as a slice of equity. And they may call it mezzanine debt. But if the EB-5 money fills in the dollars, the capital stack, the dollars that the investor, that the developer needs from 90% through 98%, you can call it a mezzanine loan, but that really has risks of equity. And we think that developers would have a natural tendency or a natural incentive to want to push where EB-5 is in the capital stack. So one of the things we like to say is, hey, in my example, if you have EB-5 that goes from 90% to 98%, well, that's only 8% of the capital stack, and isn't that good? But boy, 90% to 98% is a lot different than having an EB-5 mezzanine loan that might go from 65% to 80%.
Well, how does that affect the investor? If an investor has a project, if it goes into a project where the developers are using it more, using the EB-5 money more as equity rather than a mezzanine loan, does that make any difference as far as the investment is concerned?
Their risk of loss is greater. If a project loses 5% of its value, then they're the first ones out, right? So they start losing the money, exactly.
That's
right.
That's a great point to note.
I don't want to minimize the question about just how much of the total capital stack is EB-5. In my example, the 8% versus 15%, many EB-5 investors really prefer the EB-5 capital to be a smaller chunk of the capital stack. And that's not finance, but it is EB-5, because these investors are really concerned about the project getting done and creating jobs and them getting their green card. And so if you only have to raise 8%, then you have more visibility on the project being fully financed and being able to get completed. So we understand and appreciate that investors are concerned with how much of the capital stack is EB-5, but we think it's equally or potentially more important to know where I am in the capital stack. Because if my debt plus the senior debt goes up to 80% of the capital stack, then the developer can lose 20% of his money and all the EB-5 gets repaid.
Wow, this is very interesting. Mark, we could go on for a long time yet. Adam hasn't even touched on so many issues. So I think we definitely have to have him back.
I would agree.
Well, I would be glad to. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, Adam Green, thank you so much for coming on and really exploring with us what to look for in EB-5 real estate deals. We've explored how to look for a developer that's experienced in that they have the ability to execute with what they're doing in that particular market and that they've done it before, as well as, well, where the investor's money should end up in the capital stack and where you don't want it to end up in the capital stack. So again, Adam, thank you so much for coming on, and we do look forward to having you on again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw and Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.